8.3, Duties of the Paralegal Investigator. I just want to make a few comments about the critical points of this section and the boldface titles, captions, in this section of the textbook. Identifying witnesses. This is was a big deal for me as an investigator within the paralegal context. And a lot of times I was trying to find witnesses that we didn't even know existed, trying to find out, expand the list of witnesses in one case, starting with two witnesses that were really, we thought, witnesses for the other side. It turned out that I was wrong about that, so I learned a lesson on making assumptions about that. They ended up being very good witnesses for us. Finding out from them other people who might have been witnesses, or just through my own observations, thinking who else could have been a witness. This involved a car accident, and we wanted not only witnesses as to the accident itself, but to the character of the person who we were suing and his propensity for driving fast, driving recklessly. So we were able to identify a vice principal, other students at his high school, a staff of a church next to the high school who observed his very reckless driving on multiple occasions. Those are what we call propensity witnesses. Very, very powerful. But in that case, believe it or not, started with two witnesses, ended up with 71 witnesses that we were prepared to go to trial with. And that went a long way to helping us force the insurance company to settle, not for the minimum amount they were starting with, but for basically the full amount that we are asking for. Because if the case had gone to trial, we had so many witnesses that could testify as to the character and the risk-taking ability of this person, and in fact to the horrible parental oversight of this teenager, that we certainly would have won. Interviewing witnesses, we are going to talk about preparing an interview a little later, but this part of the textbook talks about the main concerns when interviewing witnesses, such as the introduction, the preparation of questions, the location. You want to consider what location for the interview. Sometimes you're forced to do it in not so friendly locations. I had to do one in a McDonald's once, which I would never recommend, but it was the only place I could get the person to meet. And regarding preparation of questions, you will have some attorneys who will say, oh, I just go into an interview without questions, just with a blank sheet of paper. And at the end of the day, you're going to be able to make that determination for yourself. But as we progress through this chapter, I'm going to try to convince you that it's really to your advantage and to the benefit of your career if you take the time to prepare questions before going into an interview. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. Skip tracing, that's kind of fun. That's trying to find a witness or even a client who is unknown. Usually it's somebody who doesn't really want to be found, but sometimes it's somebody who doesn't even realize they're missing, such as in a case where you've got someone who is owed money from a will or from an insurance policy, and your law firm has been hired to find that person so the payoff can be made. So it's not always a bad thing when you're trying to locate a witness or a client. Accident scene photography, I did a little bit of this. There are a lot of the tips I give you here from firsthand experience. You want to get there as quickly as you can, especially if it's an event that caused injuries or damage, whether it's a slip and fall case or more commonly a car accident. You get there as soon as you can after the accident. Now, sometimes you don't get the case till 3 or 4 weeks later, maybe even longer, but that's no reason to delay. You still try to get there as soon as you can. You get the big picture. Take pictures of the entire area. Take it from far away, from get a little closer, take more pictures, take as many as you can, especially today with digital photography. There's no excuse that your client can't afford that much film. Digital costs basically nothing to take. You can then pick or choose the ones you want to use at a later point. You also then get the small picture, not just of kind of a frame of the accident scene, but you look at things close up. You look for skid marks. You look for damage to hedges or to trees. You take pictures, again, close, far away, and everywhere in between. Scale. If you do a close-up, you want to put something such as a quarter or a pen. You want to put that in the image also, so that, or even a ruler, by the way, so that there is a sense of the scale of the object that you're taking. And time of day. This can be tough because the sun goes up and down at different points, and if you're taking a picture near sunset, it may be quite different than it was on the day that the incident occurred. But as close as possible, you want to take an image, a picture, at the same time that it occurred at during the day. A paralegal often obtains documents, sometimes from court. Usually they're public records, so it's not a problem getting those. But you have to be very, very respectful of those documents. You don't take them out of the court. You make copies at the court. Or medical records, in which case you probably will need to have permission from your client or from the patient who you're getting records from. And if they object, you may need to ask that person to come to a hearing or deposition, I should say, and submit a subpoena ducitecum. Subpoena is asking a witness to attend a deposition or a trial hearing. A subpoena ducitecum is a subpoena asking that witness to bring documents with him or her. Sometimes you send a subpoena ducitecum to a hospital asking for the custodian of records to come to the hearing with the documents, but all you really care about are the documents. And so an arrangement can be made if there's not a valid reason for the documents to be withheld. And again, usually you're going to have some sort of release. Taking statements after you've interviewed a witness. Sometimes you'll have a formal witness statement typed up and eventually sent to the witness for them to sign. That's for the most critical witnesses. That's not certainly for every witness. It wasn't real common. Informal witness statements are even less common, but actually in some cases more important. And they really only occur if I'm interviewing a witness and they say something that's important that really surprises me, something that I want to make sure I kind of lock them in. I might prepare a handwritten statement at that moment. And this was especially in cases regarding skeptical witnesses or even hostile witnesses. If they made a statement that was really beneficial to our client that surprised me, I want to get them locked in on that. So I might actually do a small witness statement at the end of the interview where I mention not just that. You don't want to let them know that's what surprised you. You mention two or three or four or five different things that they said, but one of those is the really important and surprising element, and get them to just sign it. Or if they don't feel comfortable signing it, say, well, can you at least initial it so that it can be established that you've read it, and not realizing an initial is actually just as binding as a full signature. So that didn't happen real often, but when it happened, it was really important. I do want to say, if a witness says something that's damaging to your client, you don't want to do the informal witness statement, because then you've locked it into place, and in some cases, that statement may need to be turned over to the other party during discovery, depending on your jurisdiction. So you only do that if you only prepare the statement and put into writing things that are that benefit your client, things that are to the advantage of your client. There's an old saying, never put something in writing when you don't have to, and that especially is true when you're talking about damaging information. Title searches, we discussed title searches here. Not every paralegal will conduct title searches, and this does vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from county to county. So You'll have to be a little flexible here, but we try to give you a pretty standard way of searching for a title. Internet searches, by the way, title searches have become much easier with the advent of the internet. So again, depending on how much information your county has put online, it may actually be a lot easier than we've even presented here. And we talk about internet searches. I can't stress enough how it will surprise you sometimes how much you can find on Google. And Bing is getting better. Ask.com is okay. It's not great, but you may be surprised when you're conducting investigation how much you can find with Google. And then we have a final conversation here about legal site search and legal authority search, including megalaw.com. You're being trained in Westlaw and Lexis, which are the legal authority searches that most people use. But there are other mechanisms you can use for the internet that you might want to become familiar with, and we provide them in this section.